want to do just a little bit of teaching today about Parshat Korach, and particularly what was Korach's crime. And as a reminder or background for us, Korach approaches Moshe with what seems to be a pretty reasonable sort of concern. Korach and his band approach Moses and Aaron, and they say, "You have gone too far, for all the community are holy, all of them, and God is in their midst. Why do you raise yourself above the Lord's congregation?" And so on the surface, it seems that what he is saying, what Korach is saying, is that by giving yourself some specialized role of leadership, you are acting as though you're holier than thou, and therefore your leadership itself is under question. That's sort of the presentation that Korach gives, but then we run into a problem, which you probably all know, which is, frankly, Moses falls on his face, says, you know, we're gonna let God decide this, and God decides, and the earth opens up and swallows all of Korach and his band of merry rebels into the earth, and the earth closes up again. That kind of intervention by God puts a little bit of a problem on Korach's claim that he's doing the right thing. If so, how is it that God could possibly swallow up Korach? Wouldn't that be an unjust response from the God of justice, the God of the universe? So that's the background, and we have to sit with that for a little bit to understand how desperately our commentators throughout the years have struggled to come up with something that Korach did, which on the surface, with a quick reading of the text, doesn't seem present. And some of the explanations, I think, you may have heard over the years. It's a famous one, Vayikach Korach. Korach took, but there's no direct object to that word took. And so one of our classic commentators said he took by words. He seduced people. He riled them up with his rhetorical skills so that they would rebel against. And a lot of explanations are given, all to try to come up with this notion of what possibly could have been wrong in his action. I want to share maybe a couple of notions that are a little bit less common and some commentary from modern rabbis as well, and leave you to walk home with a question. So Rambam brings a really interesting a comment from Moreh Nevuchim, in which he, in effect, says that Moses is the first prophet of the people of Israel. Moses is the first prophet. And yet, if you think about the Torah, other people have been in direct communication with God. Abraham talks to God, right? The ancestors all had a relationship. And so, wait a second, what is this role of the prophet? And Maimonides, Rambam, says that what separates or distinguishes the prophet is that they're not just speaking to God. Lots of people in the biblical world had the understanding that they spoke to God. The prophet is the person whose communication with God is in service of the people. It's not an individual goal. It's not for their own benefit. And in this case, Korach seems not to be looking out for the people as a whole. He's looking out for himself. And there's some clues to that. For example, when he talks about the community, he doesn't talk about the community as holy. He talks about each person being holy in the plural, meaning that everyone is an individual and not really thinking about the collective is this notion that's drawn out from there. And I think that's a sort of an interesting approach for that. Nachmanides, Ramban, is a little bit concerned because Moses seems to be acting without God's imprimatur. He says, he falls on his face, and then he immediately says, God will decide, bring fire pans and incense to the tent of meeting tomorrow, and we'll see who's holy. And yet nowhere in the Torah have we encountered God telling Moses that. So it would seem that Moses is not actually acting on behalf of the people. Moses seems to just be playing it fast and loose on his own. And so Rambam, trying to resolve this tension, will bring all these different sources where there's this little bit of a gap. And in that gap, we can presume that the Torah was communicated to a human being, and to Moses in this case. And there are lots of examples, right, where the human being doesn't get the command, God gives it. There are times where we don't hear God giving the command, but Moses or someone else gives it. There are times for both. And so therefore, Ramban is pulling up proof to sort of say, Moses was right. This God did speak to him. This is a justified punishment, in other words, for what happened to Korach. So there's a little bit of a sense of what our classical commentators, meaning our medievals, thought. Are you feeling satisfied yet that what happened to Korach is fair? If you think what happened is fair, raise your hands. A few hands. And if you think it's not fair, raise your hands. And if you're not sure, raise your hands. All right, so we have our agnostics, our atheists, and our believers, all in a single edah, all in a single sort of stuff. So I want to move us out of that period and into the modern with some contemporary rabbis, because I think they'll take a different approach to this this struggle that's in there. And the first part is Mark Greenspan, writing today. In fact, I got a copy of his sermon. And what he says is something sort of really interesting. He wants to take this and talk about how Korach is so indicative of the Jewish community. And it's indicative of the Jewish community because we're always talking bad about the Jews who ain't like us. And of course, you can think of some of the classical divisions between Orthodox and conservative and Reform. But he drills down even further between different flavors of Orthodoxy and sort of just really talks about this difficulty and connects this with what the rabbis connect it with, because Korach is the classic section of text that's used in Pirkei Avot to talk about what is what's a machloket l'shem shemayim, what is a argument for heaven's cause, and what's a machloket just for yourself. A machloket l'shem shemayim, or rather one that's not for the sake of heaven, is when you're just arguing for your own benefit, your own what's going to work well for you, which ties us back to Maimonides' comment and some of those others. And so for him, what really is at heart in this parsha is a reminder that we ain't there as a larger Jewish community. And by doing that, he takes this beautiful flip, and he doesn't even deal with the question as to whether or not what happened at Korach is just or not. He focuses it very powerfully on us and who we need to be. Don't you worry about whether God's fair or just. Worry about yourselves first, right? And then, you know, the rest of it will sort of come out. My teacher, Mr. Smiley, also known as Rabbi Elliot Dorf, who was always smiling, and thus we called him Mr. Smiley, talks about the difficulty he has with this parsha, how much it always bothers him, and like many of the hands in the room, how it seems that Korach is getting treated unfairly. And he does so by sort of talking about his youth and watching cowboy and Indian movies as a kid. And like the bad cowboys always had black hats, and think about the Lone Ranger always had a white hat, and so the black and white and not sort of the gray. And that he feels that Korach sort of is being portrayed with this black hat unfairly. But then he goes to the 1950s to a sort of well-known for those of us in this field, Albert George Butzer's The Interpreter's Bible. You probably have one on your shelf or have had one on your shelf at some point. And what Butzer says is that Korach's crime is not that he challenged Moshe per se, or that the people indeed are all holy, or at least have the potential. The problem was that he took an idea that was before its time, that the Israelites were not ready for this sort of radical notion of democracy that Korach was presenting, And the wrong concept, or the correct concept at the wrong time, is itself extremely dangerous and undermining to society. So for him, Korach's problem is simply not really having a proper bead on the age he lived in, on what was possible, and therefore risking the complete descent sort of into chaos because of that. And I think that's sort of an interesting thing. I'd like to imagine that if you just are ahead of your time a little bit too much, that the penalty should not be that the earth opens up and you get swallowed up. So I'm not completely convinced that that's going to be my go-to definition, but it is an interesting sort of take, and it's this process, I think, that we moderns are engaged in which we want to actually look at Korach and really give him, Dan l'chol adam l'chav zchut, give him the benefit of the doubt, sort of try to understand where he was so that he's not the black-hatted cowboy in that discussion. Another concept that Rabbi Dorf offers comes from the Nazi brown shirts. And this is an image that comes out of Martin Buber, in which the Nazi brown shirts, who are leopards and werewolves, in that they prefer chaos to order. And so what Korach's guilt is, building on that previous concept, is that he wants chaos. He doesn't care about the outcome. He doesn't care about the whether or not there. He just wants everything to sort of fall apart. And we know throughout history there have been a lot of people who benefit from chaos, who understand that if you create chaos, you don't have to worry about people being unified. You don't have to worry about a unified force against you. It benefits often those who are in a place of power. So a few little modern sorts of things. And then the final concept I want to offer comes from Rabbi Mordechai Silverstein, who's at the conservative yeshiva in Israel. And he builds on one of the threads we've discussed and just connects it. If you read Torah Sparks, you would have seen this. Connects it with a talit kulo techelet, a talis that is all blue. And when we say that about a person, it means somebody who is themselves black and white and isn't able to sort of see any differences. It comes out of the midrashic imagination in which Korach is arguing with Moses. And this is actually why, and challenging and saying that, Moses, you're just creating all our Jewish laws on your own, out of your own desire, right? If you're saying that a talis is only good, I shouldn't really speak, if it has a thread of blue in there, as it says in the Shema, then clearly a talis which is all blue should be okay. And if I have Torahs in my house, why on earth should I need a mezuzah on the doorpost? Because everything in that mezuzah is in the Torah scrolls that are in my house. And the fact that you're making these ridiculous little tiny threads and requiring a mezuzah when I have the Torah saying that same message are indications that you, Moses, have created this, that you're not speaking sort of with divine fiat. But Silverstein's point of the way this term is used in sort of modern Hebrew is about somebody who is unwilling to compromise, someone who only sees their own point of view and doesn't try or seek other people's understanding. And that is what Korach did. And when we look at the text, we see he never asks Moshe, he assumes or makes that judgment just his own point of view, and moves forward. So here's the question I'd like you to take home with you. I've given you some answers. I want you to sort of think about, what do you think Korach did wrong that would justify his punishment? And in what ways has that behavior, have you yourself engaged in that behavior at some point in your life? Because as the Netivot Shalom, the Slonim Rebbe would tell us, every bit of Torah is eternal, and we find ourselves in it and in each of the characters, even the anti-heroes, even those wearing the black cowboy hat. Shabbat Shalom.